Pamela is Associate Professor Emeritus of Brandeis University. She's an art historian and critic, and the author of a monograph on the American painter Alice Neal, Pictures of People, Alice Neal's American Portrait Gallery. Her recent research has been on activist art with an emphasis on South African art. In 2003, she organized Coexistence, Contemporary Cultural Production in South Africa for the Rose Art Museum at Brandeis and the South African National Gallery in Cape Town. In 2005 and 2006, she organized two exhibitions, Geobodies, A Question of Boundaries for the Women's Studies Research Center at Brandeis, and Cross Currents in recent video installation, Water as Metaphor for Identity, at the Tufts University Art Gallery. Her reviews have been published in Age Art Africa and Sculpture Magazine. And she, okay. From Agitprop, her paper is called From Agitprop to Elegy, William Kendrich's Designs for Shostakovich's The Nose. So you're going to start with some music?
I'm going to try. Metropolitan Opera's production of The Nose, last March, is going meant as something of a cautionary tale, and I had some lessons, object lessons I wanted to draw from Kentridge's designs and his approach to this commission from the Metropolitan Opera. Most of my objections have been answered by both Mike and John, so I'm going to feel like I am a teacher who's criticizing students after the fact when they've already addressed the issues. But at any rate, I'm going to proceed ahead, and hopefully we can have a nice discussion afterwards.
Can you see all right?
I think I can. No, I can't see a thing. I'm over 60. I need to sit down. That would be great. Okay. When commissioned in 2006 by the Metropolitan Opera Company to direct and design the sets for a work of his choice, South African artist William Kentridge selected Dmitri Shostakovich's The Nose from 1928, written at a time when the Russian avant-garde was being suppressed and Stalin was consolidating his authoritarian power. Weaving together the opera with the 1836 Gogol short story on which it's based, Kentridge revived the agitprop style and collaborative methods of the constructivist artist as worker, while providing a retrospective look at modernism's revolutionary pretensions and inevitable failures, what Kentridge calls the marriage of bad faith between politics and modernism. In its almost anarchic energy and inventiveness, the performance of The Nose in March 2010 was not a denial of the ideal of art as a change agent, that is, a vehicle for emotional agitation as well as rational propaganda. But it insisted on examining the past utopian projects in order to include a space for human tragedy and folly. What I hope to do eventually is look more carefully at the sources in Russian art, which he extensively mined for this astonishing project. But in my brief time here, I'm going to really look at some of Kentridge's early work and the object lessons it may draw for this moment of complexity, to borrow Mark Taylor's terms, in which we're living at present. So, broadly speaking, what Kentridge gives us is a work that is both propaganda and elegy. Broadly speaking, the nose is based on the tale of the social climbing collegiate assessor Kolavyov, who awakes one morning to discover a ridiculous blank space in place of his nose, and subsequently discovers his nose parading around Petersburg in a costume that indicates the high rank of a state counselor. And Kentridge then stages this as a theater of the absurd, or, as he also put it, brutal comedy. From the first notes of Shostakovich's score for the nose, the audience is blasted out of any complacent expectation. Here we go. I don't know really what's happened here to my... Yeah. Okay. There. You'll need the stage. Sorry. So for those of you who saw it... it was a quite aggressive, both visually and musically, so that definitely Kentridge took that score and its aggressive percussion motifs and translated it visually. It's a giant collage of constantly shifting centers of attention. Even assuming that one gets the pun that ad hoc, off the cuff, that is, also means the nose in Russian, we are plunged into a world where much of what is happening is beyond our comprehension. In other words, we are positioned as eyewitnesses to history, with all of the misapprehensions and ridiculous blank spaces that entails. Where traditions have yet to be sifted, perspective is lacking, and the world appears as a collage of ill-fitting and unrelated parts. Amid the welter of visual incidents that assault our eyes from all points on the set, the performers on the stage are reduced to tiny puppets at the mercy of clashing forces of the historical moment. And appropriately enough, Shostakovich himself called himself a puppet on a string. Life in the midst of chaos can only be ad hoc with few set goals. At the end of a vertiginous but exhilarating catapult through the unrelenting barrage of narrative fragments, the viewer is left to sort out the meaning of what in the end may be only an oxymoron, the sense or the rationale of the absurd. To that end, Kentridge provides the absurd with a centuries-long pedigree in modernist art and literature, and, of course, politics. So I don't have time to go in today to this Gogol's story, but and also the antecedents that Kentridge explored in Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy and Cervantes' Don Quixote. So I will cut forward to the main point here, which is... linking Russian and South African history and politics. So I will have to leave a lot of ridiculous blank spaces in between, but my argument is that Kentridge's staging of the nose was influenced by the complex moment in South Africa as the controversies, if I can have next, surrounding the candidacy and election of Jacob Zuma in 2008 coincided with the completion of the first phase of Kentridge's commission, the lecture performance and the video installation of 8 filmed fragments, I Am Not Me, The Horse Is Not Mine. Okay, so this is a little Zapiro cartoon in the Mail and Guardian that I've just decided to juxtapose with a picture of our favorite political candidate. I'll do it. But I feel that the object lessons are applicable also to the United States right now, when the founding concepts such as freedom and democracy have been reduced to right-wing agitprop. So I'll begin with a brief look at Kentridge's early work. He emerges as an artist in the late 1970s and early 1980s during the height of the struggle against apartheid and its accompanying widespread violence. Given his family history as the son of human rights lawyers, as well as his personal convictions, Kentridge allied himself, logically enough, with the resistance art movement in South Africa. And so I'm putting on a series of three prints he made in 1988 during the imposition of the state of emergency, which was in place in 1986. And these were originally designed as posters and meant to articulate for him and for the public the various approaches that artists can use to position themselves during a state of political crisis. So on the left is art in the state of grace. It depicts the formalist position, an art so divorced from reality that a woman can confuse her dinner with a hat. The second, in the center, art in the state of hope, refers, as he has written, to the kind of agitprop I was doing at the time, in which the work was subordinate to a program known in advance, a Leninist approach to printmaking. Here, the head of the female in the first one has metamorphosized into a fan dressed in empty bleachers and provided with the none-too-helpful caption, Tatlin in Berea. As agitprop, this is a flop. There is no clear message, and few South African viewers would have any idea who Tatlin was or what the fan-headed personage might be doing in that section of Johannesburg that happens to house a large sports stadium. The last one, art in a state of siege, on the other hand, with its rapacious predecessor of Soho Eckstein, would make a clearer political statement were one not required to decipher the typescript below. Cultural activity is epistemological struggle. Political activity is epistemological struggle. And London is a suburb of Johannesburg. Phrases unlikely to arouse the masses to action. What is important is that early on, Kentridge was thinking through how the lessons of the brilliant art produced in Russia between 1905 and 17 could be applied to the South African struggle at a period when Communist Party member Joe Slovo was a leader in the Umkhonto Sizwe, the armed wing of the ANC, and Slovo's wife, Ruth First, was a major Marxist theoretician of the movement. And, of course, they were close friends with the Kentridge family. The parallels were reinforced with the fall of the Soviet Union the year after these prints were made, which was rightly interpreted as an open omen for the end of apartheid. As Kentridge noted in the 2010 Art 21 documentary, Anything is Possible, can one find an art which relates to politics, in which the same ambiguities and uncertainties that one finds when describing the rest of the world also exist in the political and social questions that one is depicting? That's not the norm in political art. And John addressed this whole issue in discussing didacticism. This is something that Kentridge wants to avoid. And it's certainly didacticism is not the norm in Kentridge's art from the 1980s onward. For Kentridge, Vladimir Tatlin's model for the monument to the Third International from 1919 to 20 is an enduring emblem for the uncertain outcomes of political change. It appears in his prints from the 1980s and in both documentary film and collage form in the installation of the 8 film fragments, I Am Not Me, The Horse Is Not Mine. Because Kentridge considers it to be one of the greatest images of hope I know, the spiraling tower also becomes a tragic symbol of hopes going nowhere. As he wrote in The Horse, I Am Not Me, The Horse Is Not Mine, this is an elegy for the possibilities of human transformation that so many hoped for during the Russian Revolution. A final work from the resistance art era of the 1980s, this one from 1989, on the left, it's a large charcoal examines the calamitous end of the avant-garde in the figure of the Russian poet Vladimir Mayakovsky, who committed suicide in 1930, the year Shostakovich's opera was first performed. His poem, Left March, from 1919, same time as Tatlin's monument, begins. About turn, march, away with a talk show, silence you speakers, Comrade Mauser, you have the floor. Kentridge's monument to Mayakovsky, and the name, as you can see, is written in blue in Russian, provides an object lesson about the futility of the use of violent means, the Mauser pistol, to effect change. The possible futures that Kentridge was envisioning for Gogol's short story include as well Jacob Zuma's inflammatory chants of the MK's anthem, Umshimi Wami, bring me my machine gun, during his election campaign of 2008. I'll just mention that on the right there is his death mask that's in a museum in Armenia, actually, and that he used in order to draw Mayakovsky's portrait. That campaign from 2008, Jacob Zuma's campaign, where the theme was bring me my machine gun, happened to coincide with the catastrophic outbreak of xenophobic violence that May. Certainly in part the result of the fact that the majority of the population in South Africa continues to live in extreme poverty even after over 15 years of democracy. So because of that political situation, very volatile political situation in 2008, when his I Am Not Me, The Horse Is Not Mine appears in public for the first time, premiered in Sydney, Australia, those parallels would not be lost on him, and it's the one thing he was willing to confirm for me in the process of writing this paper. Turning now to the opera itself, the image of Shostakovich in the form of a fragmented metal sculpture or a clip of documentary film provides a brief nod to traditional notions of authorship. I still feel, though, that the composer himself is not the tragic figure of this theater of the absurd. I argue that that honor belongs to a figure who is not pictured at all, but who is a central player in Russian revolutionary history, Nikolai Bukharin, 1888 to 1938. Excuse me. While other leaders of the 1917 revolution, some of whom were shot during the purges, such as Grigory Zinoviev, who's there on the right, and others who survived, such as Molotov, appear in prints and projections with their noses or faces excised, we are provided only with scrolled excerpts from Bukharin's testimony during his treason trial before the plenum of the Central Committee of 1937. In other words, this blank, black screen, the only one where Kentridge really didn't feel he could make an image that was a counterpart to the text, is an epitaph for Bukharin. Though still a loyal member of the Central Committee, Bukharin was doomed along with the remaining Bolsheviks who might pose a threat to Stalin. And at his trial, this brilliant theoretician was reduced to quoting children's verses. I don't know if my crummy slide is legible there at all, but he talks about a children's verse where he talks about beating somebody with a stone and saying that, in fact, he is the one who is beaten with a stone. Kentridge wrote and has in his performance said, the tragedy of his situation resides in the impossibility of reconciling the need to believe in the party and the cause to which he had given his life with the new world of illogic, of line, of strategy, which he had embraced for the sake of his party. Herein lies the tragedy of his life, but also its comedy. A comedy of inversions, where things mean their opposite, where logical argument is a sure sign of duplicity, and lying is explained away as a strategy. in a final letter to Stalin asking to be poisoned rather than shot, what an option, Bukharin wrote, "Finally, I need to know, did you really believe what was said?" And Kentridge describes this as a futile attempt to rescue himself by rescuing language from the labyrinth into which it had fallen. Language is splayed and displayed all over the surface of the sets for the nose, and sound bites unmoored and removed from context and therefore unintelligible, even if in English rather than Russian. Hence the centrality of Kovalev's trip to the newspaper office, pictured as a kind of giant recycling bin. Bukharin was the editor of Pravda from 1918 to 1929, during which time radically different versions of the truth were papered over. In the Met's production, the reporters do not cover the news so much as are covered by it, and also submerged in the chaos and the welter of history. And newspapers in Kentridge's work are never used for information. They're always covering up dead bodies, as in fact happened in South Africa during the apartheid era. Is the social climbing nose in His Majesty, the nose, a part of the I Am Not Me series of projections, representative of all the fallen Bolsheviks? And is the nose projected in the set's upper register even after Kovalev is finally happily reattached to his nose, not simply assassinated, but shot into myriad collage fragments? Have we got here at the end of the opera, then, the image of the triumph of the police state? Whether or not Kentridge intended to specifically highlight this historical figure in creating the nose, the elusive appendage itself is at once a vainglorious pretender, a latter-day Ubu-Wa, an anarchist, and a heroic leader. As Maria Goff has explained in her fine essay, Kentridge's Nose, highly recommended, it's in the fall 2010 issue of October, given the revolution's recourse to violence, terror was necessarily latent within it. This conundrum is visualized in A Lifetime of Enthusiasm, another one of the eight projections, and also projected in the opera, by the red banner of hope that disintegrates as anonymous mortals trudge across a ramp and disappear over the course of their lifetime of enthusiasm to which the citizens were condemned to be condemned under Stalin. Quite a different image from the poster that is below left there for Ziga Vertra's praise of the five-year plans, the film Enthusiasm, released in 1931, how appropriate, the year that after the nose was briefly performed. Rather than a constructivist image, Kentris appears to have based the outsized revolutionary banner on an early social realist painting from 1920, which is on the lower right there, thereby referencing the future art of the USSR, if not of Bolshevism itself. And as early as 1919, Lenin was calling for reliable anti-futurists. He wanted to do away with all of this incredible artistic activity that Mike described to us. So are these people, members of the citizenry, not just victims, but also perpetrators? The cast created for the opera seems so mild in their costumes. But among the costume figures, and these are the scale models for the opera stage that Kentridge constructed in his studio, and you can see that one of the group of figures, I have one more minute, spells out the word insane. So my point is that it's a reminder that irrationality and even insanity can lurk under the surface of everyday appearance. And that is where the absurd finds its refuge. Okay, now for my last minute, I'm going to turn to pure polemic, and as I say, Mike and John have already answered my my objections. Can the nose, as diffuse and bleak as it is, be a model for the new agitprop? Kentridge has denied that he's a moral relativist, arguing that to say one needs art or politics that incorporate ambiguity and contradiction is not to say that then one stops recognizing and condemning things as evil. However, it might stop one from being so utterly convinced of the certainty of one's own solutions. There needs to be a strong understanding of fallibility and how the very act of certainty or authoritativeness can bring disasters. So it seems to me that the stage that we're in now, which is the triumph of casino capitalism, provides us with some messages, even though definitely Kentridge would wash his hands of what I'm going to say now. But my problem really is with the huge propaganda machine of the right wing, which has had dramatic success in agitating previously apolitical segments of our society. And it seems to me that the left considers it not worthy of attention because its claims are so silly and its lies are so blatant. But the pronouncements of a Glenn Beck or a Sarah Palin or a Rush Limbaugh are not simply silly. As has been pointed out, they're incentives to violence and upheaval, and the public has responded with their own Mausers and machine guns. An agitprop that fails to engage this propaganda directly is toothless. And so I've been thinking about George Orwell's aphorism, "In times of universal deceit, telling the truth will be a revolutionary act." But the question is, to whom? It's an especially difficult task to craft a message that can reach across those to those whose lack of security causes them to latch onto the lies told by Murdoch's minions. And so I'll leave you with what I hope is provocative fragments for a new collage of agitprop. Thanks.